The headlines: Brit is bracing for more disruptive strike actions as the rail and maritime union rejects an offer from operators to end a long-running dispute over pay rise. A price cap imposed on Russia's seaborne oil by the G7 and the European Union comes into force. Moscow says it will not abide by the cap. And Israeli forces raid a refugee camp near the occupied West Bank city of Bethlehem, killing a young Palestinian and injuring several more. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: Britain's rail and maritime union rejects the 4% pay rise proposed by train operators to end the highly disruptive strike action by rail workers. The RMT union says the offer does not meet its criteria for securing long-term job security for its members. Last week, the union said more than 40,000 workers would stage strikes in December and January, signaling major Christmas disruptions. The union also organized major industrial actions that caused massive disruptions in the summer. Britain has witnessed a series of walkouts across different sectors over the past months. The government is now considering using the military's help to fill in for striking workers ahead of key walkouts by nurses and ambulance staff. News review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. A price cap, the group of seven countries imposed on Russia's seaborne oil, has come into force. This as the West tries to limit Moscow's ability to finance its war in Ukraine. The European Union has also banned all imports of seaborne crude from Russia. That's besides a similar $60 limit the bloc has placed on Russia's oil. The moves by the EU and the G7 mean third-party countries cannot use their tankers, insurance firms, and credit institutions if the cargo is sold at a price higher than their designated ceiling. In response, Russia is saying that it won't sell its oil to countries that apply the price cap. It says such Western moves are to blame for the current imbalance in the energy markets. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Jerome Hughes, who's joining us from Brussels. Also, we have journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich joining us from Belgrade. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Jerome in Brussels. Walk us through all the details that we need to know about this EU and G7 imposed price cap on Russian oil.
That's right, Bardia. Well, this is sort of the latest pressure from the West, so to speak, to try and apply more pressure on Russia. And as you mentioned in the introduction, Russia has said that, you know, it won't recognize this cap, and it's even willing, it says, to reduce production if necessary. Well, you've heard from Vladimir Zelensky as well, the Ukrainian president, who says that this has shown weakness from the West because they wanted, or he wanted, Ukraine wanted a cap of, at least $30 per barrel of oil, or actually just a complete ban on Russian oil altogether. That's what they would have wanted. Because actually, if you listen to what the industry experts are saying, that, you know, before the war in Ukraine, Russia was typically selling its oil for around typically between $55 and $65 dollars per barrel of oil. So, you know, this cap of $60, it doesn't seem to be maybe having the desired effect, especially when you have a case. I mean, you mentioned about the G7 countries and the EU countries. Those tankers won't be able to go above this cap. But actually, Russia itself has plenty of its own tankers. And you already have the likes of China, which has said that it is happy to go with the status quo with its current arrangements with Russia in terms of its energy supplies. And of course, China is a major customer, it's a major consumer of oil. So actually, you know, the EU and the G7 countries are saying this is designed to try and stop Russia's war machine. Well, actually, you know, in terms of what we've seen so far with all of these energy restrictions that they've tried to impose on Russia, well, actually, one of the main beneficiaries so far has been the United States, because it produces plenty of its own gas and oil. So it's been able to sell gas, for example, liquefied natural gas, to the EU at huge prices. So actually, it's doing very well. But the block that's really struggling are the 27 countries of the EU that are really struggling to find energy at a reasonable price. So while the United States, it's argued, you know, has been behind this push by NATO and the West against Russia and creating this conflict in Ukraine, it's actually not doing too badly. But actually the EU itself that's been dragged into this is really struggling. The cost of living crisis is getting worse. Interest rates are going to be raised again this month by the European Central Bank to try and bring down inflation. And it's all because of huge energy costs. So while the West, or apparently they're saying it's to try and put pressure on Russia, Russia can continue to sell its oil to the likes of China. The EU will continue to struggle as the winter gets colder. And the United States is doing fine. Thank you very much.
Mr. Bosnich, give us your thoughts on this recent price cap. Russia has already said that it won't abide by it.
Well, obviously not. Oil is one of those commodities that literally flows in the direction of the markets which are willing to pay for it. And if the European Union is going to put another nail in their own economic coffin, they can do so. Because what they are going to do, in effect, is to make sure that they will not be receiving any Russian oil that they had hoped to receive. And so their own efforts to punish Russia will once again boomerang on the EU, thereby accelerating and worsening the crisis that they're already facing. You couldn't have made a worse decision. That's the best way to describe what the EU is now doing.
And staying with you, Mr. Bosnich, how far does the EU have to go, basically, to understand that all these measures to pressure Russia, specifically when it comes to the energy sector, is actually backfiring?
Well, you know, if you find a man on the side of the street strangling himself, so long as he's still standing and not dead, then basically he can keep on doing whatever he likes. It's his personal right to do so. I think the situation here is that the EU, in its anxiety to keep in the good books of America, which actually created the EU and created the NATO pact around the EU structures as a kind of a lockdown for European monies that would have to flow into the American economy, that actually the EU has no way out except to try to force a conflict, as they have been trying to do between the United States directly and Russia. And everything that they're doing now, including these price caps, which will not work so long as there's a China on this earth, no fake EU price caps will have any effect other than to boomerang directly in their own faces.
Jerome, what do you think about that issue? If the EU is basically dancing to the tune of the United States, then where does it leave the civilians, the EU civilians here in this conundrum? Are they on board with all the hardships that they have to endure?
In terms of the massive outpouring of empathy that we saw for the people, the ordinary citizens of Ukraine, quite rightly, when this thing escalated in February, you know, I'm sorry to say, but slowly but surely, people, because of their own personal circumstances, that empathy has been waning, and their sort of apathy has set in towards this entire conflict, because there are so many elements to it. We could be talking all day. It's not just about, you know, high energy prices. High energy prices are fueling the inflation, which is the cost of living, the price of food. Rents are going up, mortgages are going up because the interest rates are going up, but also we have the refugee crisis. You have more and more refugees now coming from Ukraine because it's getting colder there, because of the energy problems in Ukraine, and the EU is really not capable of taking in so many refugees. That we just don't have the housing stock here in most of the EU countries, and also the financial side of it. The huge amounts of money that are being spent on spending billions of euro into Ukraine to keep the war going, and also billions of euro to keep the government in Ukraine going and to try and keep the country functioning. And the EU simply can't afford it. So people are asking, where is the money coming from? Well, it's the taxpayers that are paying for it. But ultimately, what we're worried about here is that we could see a rising number of job losses. And if unemployment gets out of control in the EU and in the Eurozone, then this whole project, which was started off, by the way, as a peace project, it's now sort of a military project, it will simply collapse, because the only thing saving the European Union at the moment is that actually employment has remained stable. But when that starts to shift, we're really going to have a major problem then. And all of the powers that be know that. But really, what are they doing? Instead of trying to talk about perhaps peace negotiations or to ask to act as a peace broker, they just seem to be focused on keeping the conflict going. But citizens, as you mentioned, they are noticing more and more. And then you have countries like Moldova, which is positioned right in between Ukraine and EU country Romania, and it's completely on its knees at the moment. Inflation is at 30%. They're without electricity most of the time because they're so dependent on Russian energy. And they were the great guys at the start, taking in Ukrainian refugees. But now they're being left to their own devices. We don't hear much about Moldova anymore. So it's not just the EU citizens, but it's actually the other countries that they're impacting. And so really, there doesn't seem to be an end in sight, which is the most frightening thing about all of this.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Jerome Hughes, our correspondent, joining us from Brussels. And thanks to journalist John Bosnet, joining us from Belgrade. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. But do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come. Tehran condemns the U.S. attempt to remove Iran from the U.N. Commission on the status of the women, calling it a legitimate foreign ministry. Spokesman Nasser Kanani says Washington is trying to block independent states' right to a free vote on international bodies. Kanani says Iran earned membership in the commission after a recent voting session by the U.N. Economic and Social Council. The spokesman says that the U.S. Move questions the legality of such mechanisms in internal bodies. The U.S. is pushing a draft resolution at the Council to remove Iran from the U.N.'s Commission on the Status of Women. The country has just started a four-year term on the body. Tehran has repeatedly warned that some Western countries are exploiting human rights for their own political ends. Iran's foreign minister has accused the United States and some of its Western allies are being behind the recent riots in the country. Hossein Amir Abdullahian, during an official visit to Serbia, said Washington and its allies have always sought to create turmoil in Iran. He said recent riots were fomented through foreign interference and represented a hybrid war against the Iranian people. He added that one of the goals of Washington through the riots was to get more concessions from Tehran in the negotiations aimed at reviving the 2015 deal. Amir Abdullahian reiterated that a deal on the JCPOA would be acceptable to Tehran only if it was beneficial to the Iranian nation and durable. The riots in Iran began after the death of young woman Mahsa Amini in September. She collapsed at a police station in Tehran and later died at hospital. Israeli forces kill yet another Palestinian in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry says 23-year-old Omar Manah was shot at Dahesha refugee camp near Bethlehem this morning. He was reportedly hit in the chest by live fire. Six others were injured by Israeli fire. The Palestinian factions in the Bethlehem area have declared a general strike and a day of mourning. Israeli forces have been killing Palestinians almost in the occupied West Bank on a daily basis. The regime forces have killed more than 200 Palestinians in the Palestinian territory so far this year. We earlier asked our West Bank correspondent, Mona Kandil, for more details on the latest Israeli raid in the area.
Refugee camp in Bethlehem to conduct an arrest campaign. This is according to a statement issued by the Israeli military. The Israeli soldiers stormed a number of houses in Adhesha refugee camp. Of course, Palestinians have resisted the incursion or the raid of the Israeli forces to Adhesha refugee camp. Clashes took place between Palestinian youths and Israeli forces. As you have mentioned, 23-year-old Omar Manah was shot and killed during this operation. Six others were wounded as well. and the Israeli forces arrested three Palestinians. Two of them are brothers. The Israeli military accuses those Palestinians who were detained in Adhesi refugee camp that they are engaged in a number of anti-Israeli activities. Elsewhere in the occupied West Bank, another raid was have taken place to Jenin area. This time, the Israeli forces unfortunately succeeded to arrest Palestinian activist and fighter. He is the son of Bassam Assadi, the senior leader of the jihad movement, and he's also a Palestinian prisoner in Israeli jails. The Israeli forces said the main aim to Jenin incursion is to arrest the son of Bassam Assadi, the senior official of the jihad movement in northern occupied West Bank.
The Persian Gulf island of Bahrain is hosting the Israeli president the first time. That has happened in Bahrain's history. As much as Israel would like to show that its relations with Persian Gulf Arab countries is flourishing, their citizens are vehemently against the normalization of ties and have vowed to never recognize Israel.
Protesters in the Persian Gulf island of Bahrain, they're chanting death to Israel. Their reason: the Israeli President Isaac Herzog was visiting the Persian Gulf island, the first Israeli president visiting Bahrain. The day before, protesters carried signs with Herzog's image that said criminal and you are not welcome in Bahrain. Opposition activists launched a campaign on social media speaking out against normalization with Israel. But why was Herzog visiting Bahrain in the first place? And why was there such opposition to his visit? As for the reason of his visit, it was at the invitation of King Hamad bin Isa al-Khalifa. It is reported that he will meet with members of the local Jewish community and senior government officials. He will also lead a group of Israeli business people to meet with the Bahraini Economic Development Board. But these things could be done by other officials from Israel. It wouldn't need the Israeli president to make a trip to Bahrain for that, unless there are other reasons for the visit. For starters, Israel needs to maintain a high-profile presence when it comes to its relationship with Persian Gulf Arab leaders. This is crucial for Israel as part of the so-called normalization process. Israel normalized ties with the UAE and Bahrain in 2020 as part of the U.S.-brokered Abraham Accords. The agreement paved the way for the normalization with Morocco months later. But the U.S.-led process has not taken off quite the way the U.S. and Israel intended to. For although the leaders of Israel and UAE and Bahrain may have gotten closer, the population of these Arab countries have displayed anger and animosity towards Israel, as was evident in the World Cup in Qatar. The reason for this amount of anger toward Israel is very clear: Palestine and Palestinians.
What is this?
Israel channel. You don't like us?
You are not welcome here. There is only Palestine. There is no Israel.
Israel's continued repression and violation of Palestinian rights throughout the decades has been met with some Arab leaders engaging with Israel through the so-called Abraham Accords. For their citizens, this is unacceptable and a betrayal of the Palestinian cause. It appears that the Abraham Accords have become a substitute for improving the lives of Palestinians.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Current world order will be replaced by a new order where US is isolated, Asia powerful, resistance front expanded. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with students on Wednesday, November 2nd, 2022. This meeting was held on the occasion of National Students' Day and National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance, which are commemorated on the 13th of Aban, 4th of November. Ever since the Industrial Revolution took place and the Europeans started advancing and colonizing other countries, they made the people and the countries of the world get used to the fact that submission and dominance are two inevitable corresponding parts of the world. This means that the world is split into domineering governments and countries and states that can be dominated. This has been the situation, and this domination system has been around for several centuries. Everyone agreed that they should accept the domination of Western powers, even their culture and appellations. Let me say this here. I have said it before, they call our region the Middle East. What does the Middle East even mean? It means that the origin and center of the world is Europe, like the story about Mullah Nasruddin, where they asked him where the center of the world is, and he replied, "The place where the nail of my donkey's brains are pounded into the ground. That is the center of the world."
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Any region that is far from Europe is called the Far East, because it is far from Europe. Whichever country is close to it, like some North African countries, are considered to be in the Near East. Those that are in the middle of these are known as the Middle East. That is the basis for naming countries by Europe. That is how Westerners were so self-entitled.
This is why I insist on not calling the Middle East, but West Asia instead. It is in West Asia, after all. Why should we call it the Middle East? The Islamic Republic was the one who formed the spirit of showing resistance toward the tyranny, power-seeking, and hegemony of the domineering powers. The first person in the world to say neither East nor West was Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The U.S. president said on Thursday that he would be willing to speak to Vladimir Putin if he truly wants to end the war. That was the first time he had expressed willingness to speak with the Russian leader since the beginning of the war in February, around which time he said that he will not be speaking with Putin. He made his comments as he was delivering a speech at a joint White House news conference with French President Emmanuel Macron. Here's what he said about the war in Ukraine and the unrealistic conditions under which he would speak to Putin.
Look, there's one way for this war to end, the rational way. Putin to pull out of Ukraine, number one. But it appears he's not going to do that. But the fact of the matter is, I have no immediate plans to contact Mr. Putin. Mr. Putin is, I choose my words very carefully. I'm prepared to speak with Mr. Putin. If, in fact, there is an interest in him deciding he's looking for a way to end the war, he hasn't done that yet.
Biden further added, if that's the case, in consultation with my French and my NATO friends, I'll be happy to sit down with Putin to see what he has in mind, as he and Macron vowed long-term support for Ukraine. The Kremlin took note of Biden's comments and responded through its spokesman, Dmitry Peskov. He said that Putin remains open to negotiations, but he is not going to pull his troops out of Ukraine. Peskov emphasized another unrealistic condition that Biden had set for talking with Putin. That would be the West's refusal to recognize the quote-unquote new territories that Russia annexed during the controversial September referendums. All that said, Peskov was not dismissive of the potentiality of talks between the two superpowers. While outlining Russia's conditions for the talks, he said, President Putin has been, is, and remains open for contacts for negotiations. Of course, the most preferable way to achieve our interests is through peaceful diplomatic means. While it is difficult to assess both parties' actual willingness to talk, what is objectively true is the fact that President Biden had not expressed any willingness to sit down with Putin with or without the unrealistic conditions he set. Could it be that the very difficult winter ahead of Ukraine and the rest of Europe is making the West reconsider negotiating with Putin? While President Biden was playing fast and loose with the idea of holding peace talks and simultaneously setting unrealistic prerequisites for it, President Macron expressed a more dovish tone by simply saying, I will continue to talk to President Putin as he called for efforts, quote, to prevent escalation and to achieve concrete results. Macron also stated that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has also shown, quote unquote, real willingness to pursue peace. Elsewhere in Europe, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz spoke with President Putin on the phone and urged the Russian leader to find a diplomatic solution to the war as soon as possible. Scholz also called for the Russian troops to fully withdraw from Ukraine, an unlikely scenario to unfold. Putin told Scholz on the phone that Germany and the entire Western Bloc's approach towards Ukraine was destructive, as he called on Scholz to rethink his approach. It is unclear whether or not Germany, France, or the U.S. would initiate peace talks with Russia, but it seems that, at the very least, they are leaving the option on the table, despite some major disagreements between the two sides on the prerequisites for the talks. Something that was expected to hurt the potentiality of peace talks, but doesn't seem to now, is the price cap that was going to be imposed on Russian oil by the G7, EU, and Australia. They have, in fact, imposed a price cap at $60 per Russian crude oil barrel, but the amount is actually well above what Russian oil is trading for right now. This means that Russian oil will still flow and that the West has not been able to find an alternative source to Russian oil, as Russia is still the major oil provider for the countries setting the price cap. The chair of Russian Lower House's Foreign Affairs Committee, Leonid Slutsky, believes that the price cap will only end up jeopardizing EU's energy security as the world waits to see how Russia will react to the move.
The General Assembly has voted in favor of a pro-Palestinian resolution to commemorate the Nakba, or Catastrophe Day, which marks the Israeli regime's claiming existence in 1948. The Assembly adopted the resolution with 90 votes in favor, 30 negative votes, and 47 abstentions. The initiative was sponsored by Egypt, Jordan, Senegal, Tunisia, Yemen, and the Palestinians, and was approved despite the opposition of the US, UK, and Israel, and most European Union countries. 47 states abstained. The UN resolution calls for a, quote, commemoration of the 75th anniversary of the Nakba, including by organizing a high-level event at the General Assembly Hall in May 2023. The resolution also urges the dissemination of relevant archives and testimonies. Nakba Day, or Day of Catastrophe, falls on May 15 of each year. The date commemorates events that led to the Israeli regime forcibly expelling hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their homes in order to make way for the Israeli settlers 74 years ago.
Regrettably today, in the absence of a just solution, 75 years since the General Assembly's decision to partition historic Palestine with the adoption of Resolution 181 Roman II and the prolongation of Israel's occupation, now for over 55 years, the Palestinian people, including the Palestine refugees, continues to experience increasing levels of dispossession, displacement, violence, human rights violations, and insecurity.
The General Assembly also adopted other resolutions on the question of Palestine. They called for an immediate halt to settlement activities, land confiscation and home demolitions, the release of prisoners, and an end to arbitrary detentions.
The ongoing expansion of by Israel by the occupying power of illegal settlements in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem, and the attendant settler violence, which is also on the rise, need decisive action. These illegal actions constitute grave breaches of international law and are a flagrant obstruction of the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination.
Separately, the UN General Assembly adopted a resolution regarding the Syrian Golan Heights, which the Israeli regime has been occupying for more than half a century. The resolution has demanded the withdrawal of the regime from that area. It called on Israel to implement the resolutions of the Security Council and to withdraw from the Golan to the line of June 4, 1967. On Thursday, Israeli forces killed two Palestinians during a raid near the city of Jenin in the northern part of the occupied West Bank. Before raiding Jenin, Israeli forces attacked the town of Yabad, southwest of Jenin, and killed a 22-year-old man there. This is not an isolated act of violence against Palestinians.
Israeli occupation forces have ramped up military activity in the West Bank, killing more Palestinians during the past months. Since the start of 2022, Israeli troops have killed more than 200 Palestinians, including more than 50 children in the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds, as well as the besieged Gaza Strip. That is the highest record of killings since the year 2006.
In 2022, we have witnessed a dangerous escalation in Israeli military raids across the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, leading to the killing and injury of more civilians, including women and children.
And none of the soldiers have been investigated to any of the crimes. This is a clear indication how the policy of the coming Israeli cabinet will be: more killings and more aggression.
Israeli officials have described the security situation in the occupied West Bank as dangerous. They've even suggested that the regime could face another intifada or uprising. Palestinians have vowed to respond against Israel's acts of aggression. On November 23, two separate explosions rocked two bus stations at the entrance of occupied Al-Quds. The blasts were in response to a long period of ongoing Israeli oppression of the Palestinian people. The tensions come as Israel is about to have one of the most extreme right-wing cabinets in the coming weeks. The cabinet, which is headed by Benjamin Netanyahu, is controversial due to the controversial Israeli politicians who've been mired in corruption and controversies.
France and the United States are considered longtime allies with lots of cultural commonalities. But when it comes to trade, there are signs that the two longtime allies are heading for a confrontation. The French President Emmanuel Macron is visiting the United States on an official visit to boost ties. But during his trip there, Macron had some tough words directed against Washington for what he described as U.S. protectionism for its own industries. Emmanuel Macron is warning that the newly announced U.S. industrial subsidies could split the West. Macron arrived in Washington on Tuesday for his second state visit to the U.S. since taking office in 2017. French officials say Macron will confront President Joe Biden over the subsidies contained in the Inflation Reduction Act. The controversial act was signed by President Joe Biden back in August, and the Biden administration signed that with the Democratic-controlled Congress in a bid to boost U.S. domestic production and create more jobs there.
To a groundbreaking chips and science law that's going to ensure that technologies and jobs of the future are made here in America. In America. And all this progress is part of our vision and plan and determined effort to get the job done for the American people.
Well, things started really well off with Joe Biden. There was a lot of, you know, handshaking and shoulder rubbing. We're in this together and extremely friendly relations until AUKUS. AUKUS obviously was lived in France like a major betrayal. And it was painful, and nobody tried to hide, you know, how feelings were hurt.
France is not the only European nation to complain about the U.S. Inflation Reduction Act. Many European leaders have also complained about the legislative package. They say the package unfairly disadvantages non-American companies and would be a serious blow to their economies. The legislation could potentially be disastrous for car makers, especially in Germany and in France. Berlin and France have warned that if Washington does not scale back, they will introduce countermeasures against the United States. European leaders are mulling over the idea of a Buy European Act, just like the Americans. Germany, which is considered the EU's economic powerhouse, has also supported the French calls for more protection for European businesses and manufacturers. There are now talks of countermeasures similar to the U.S. scheme if Washington refuses to address key concerns. Brussels has made it clear that the U.S. legislation to subsidize its own businesses at the expense of its European partners represents a form of economic protectionism that undermines the rules of the World Trade Organization. The controversial act in the Biden administration comes after 4 years of rocky relations between the U.S. and Europe during the tenure of the former President Donald Trump.
Well, during the Trump presidency, the European-American, the French-American relation was quite conflictual and difficult, because in the White House was a president who didn't believe in alliance, who undermined NATO every step of the way, even talked about, you know, NATO being obsolete, and there was, according to him, a need to move on. He stepped out of the climate agreement on climate. He stepped out of a negotiation on the Iran nuclear program. Everybody remembers that Emmanuel Macron tried to soften somehow Donald Trump, and that it didn't work out.
Furthermore, on the U.S.'s discriminatory policies against the EU are seen as particularly harmful at a time when the world faces an economic slowdown because of the COVID-19 pandemic, the Ukraine war, and trade bottlenecks. It is now believed that the U.S. is using the war in Ukraine to its own advantage by imposing its will on the EU.
Last week, the UN Human Rights Council convened a meeting at the request of Germany and Iceland to discuss alleged human rights violations in Iran during the handling of recent riots in the country. The intergovernmental body voted to establish an independent international fact-finding mission to investigate the purported abuses. In reaction, Tehran has dismissed the move. Iran's foreign ministry said the country will not cooperate with the mission, stressing that it has already formed a national fact-finding committee to look into the events. Spokesman Nasser Kanani made the remarks at a press briefing in the Iranian capital of Tehran, as he showed up with a chemical mask in the presser, which alluded to Germany's support for Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein during the 1980 to 1988 Iraqi-imposed war on Iran. Kanani lashed out at Germany for co-sponsoring the anti-Iran resolution at the Geneva-based council, saying Germany is the same country that supplied chemical weapons to the former Iraqi Ba'ath regime during the 1980s war with Iran. Official reports indicate that in 1980, under the rule of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, Baghdad purchased over 1,000 tons of mustard agents from the West. Germany, the US, the UK, Italy, and the Netherlands were among the countries providing the Ba'athist regime with equipment and material to build chemical weapons. Over 350 large-scale chemical attacks on Iran-Iraq border between 1980 to 1988 on soldiers and civilians left Iran with more than 100,000 victims. Tens of thousands died on the spot, and many more suffered for years as a result of exposure to chemical agents. Elsewhere in his remarks, the spokesman of Iran's foreign ministry underlined that several United Nations reports have pointed to the fact that German companies were supplying the former Iraqi regime with chemical weapons. Kanani also condemned the hasty employment of human rights mechanisms and instrumental use of them against independent states, emphasizing that such an approach will not provide any help for the advancement of human rights. The Iranian Foreign Ministry has summoned German ambassador to Tehran after the UN Human Rights Council convened a meeting at the request of Berlin and passed a resolution against the Islamic Republic. The ministry conveyed Tehran's strong protest against the interventionist and baseless statements of German authorities to the ambassador. Tehran denounced the recent passage of an anti-Iranian resolution at the UN Human Rights Council over the recent developments in Iran as a wrong measure founded on a completely politicized and instrumental approach to human rights, which is categorically rejected. The collaboration of Germany and certain European countries with the unilateral coercive measures imposed by the U.S. has resulted in violation of the human rights of Iranians and strips them of any legitimacy and competence to make claims about human rights advocacy. Earlier in November, Tehran summoned the German ambassador over interventionist and irresponsible comments by the European country's head of state, Olaf Scholz, in support of the recent Western-instigated riots in Iran. Tehran blames foreign provocations for the riots in the country, saying it has provided evidence to countries whose nationals were involved in inciting unrest. The rioters have been going on a rampage across the country, attacking security forces, resorting to vandalism against public property, and desecrating religious sanctities. Earlier in the month, Iran's intelligence ministry said the United States and the United Kingdom were directly involved in the recent riots, adding that dozens of terrorists affiliated with the Zionist regime and anti-revolution groups have also been detained in the unrest. The European Union and some Western countries imposed sanctions on Iran over its approach toward the riots. Iran, in turn, announced retaliatory sanctions against institutions and individuals in the European Union due to their deliberate actions in support of terrorism and terrorist groups during the riots.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat Orbat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha
This is a part of political divine will of the founder of Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. We all should know that it is the political religious ceremonies that give Muslims, particularly the Shia Muslims, these followers of infallible Imams, the unity they should enjoy. These also preserve the nationality of all Muslims. This politico-religious testament of mine is not intended for the great nation of Iran only. Rather, it is recommended to all Islamic nations and oppressed peoples of the world, regardless of their religion or nationality.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Lovely listeners, sisters and brothers from all over the world. You're listening to Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio. This is Sister Musavi. Well, in this program, we talk on the sentences and valuable expressions of Imam Khomeini on different subjects. One of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi's part of a speech about knowledge and the knowledgeable is this. If our country acquires knowledge and culture and learn how to direct knowledge and action, no power can rule over it. This sentence shows the necessity of knowing knowledge. There are several messages implied in it, and one is that the victory of a nation can be achieved under the umbrella of knowledge. So knowledge is a pillar for power. And if the government intends to be respected by other nations, it must learn different aspects of knowledge. The knowledge of a nation must be accompanied by culture, which means that working on the cultural aspect of a nation is of utmost importance. These cultural aspects are things like, you know, moral values, social participations, and conventions that are required to be followed in order to give the nation a sense of unity. So, you see that the important theme is that Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, does not merely focus on knowledge, but also on other aspects like culture and other things that we're going to talk about after a short break. Well, one important point, just as Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, rightly mentions, is the direction of knowledge, which is very important and which means that not every type of knowledge is accommodating for the society. As a lover of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayhi, I interpret this sentence in this way, that the best way of directing a field of science or knowledge is to make it useful for people. Such an important hint that Imam is making represents his enlightened view that directs the most effective use of knowledge. Another lesson found in this speech is that in order for a nation to be strong and unbeatable, it must fortify not only its political power, but also other aspects like culture, science, and this is the secret of victory. Well, for closing, let's just repeat the sentence of Imam once more. If our country acquires knowledge and culture and learn how to direct knowledge and action, no power can rule over it.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. As you know, on this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the dual policy of the Indian government towards religious minorities and the Hindu nationalist BJP party's focus on the so-called Pasmanda, or backward Muslims, ahead of civil body polls in Uttar Pradesh state. And we shall also look at the power crisis in Bangladesh and its strategic implications for the fastest-growing economy in the South Asian region.
Ironically, Indian Muslims have been facing some of the daunting challenges in their country, being ruled by the Hindu nationalist BJP party at the center and in the majority of provinces. But the BJP government has decided to take the Muslim question not from the top, but from the bottom, meaning those who are worse than low-caste Hindus, such as Dalits, tribals, and other backward classes, or OBCs. Some observers believe the party at the helm is pursuing a strategy to target the Pasmandas, the most socio-economically oppressed class of Indian Muslims. Earlier this year, Prime Minister Narendra Modi asked his party leaders to reach out to downtrodden sections of communities other than Hindus. Modi's call for economic and social empowerment to the communities, including backward Muslims, surprised both the critics and Hindutva forces who want India to be declared a Hindu state.
The caste system and ancient hierarchical order based on one's birth is nothing but a disease that has plagued not only the Indian Hindu society, but South Asia as a whole. Despite regional and cultural variations, caste is a common feature among all religious communities in this region and plays a pivotal role in the distribution and control of knowledge, power, property, resources, sexuality, and dignity. Indian Muslims do not have caste hierarchy, but they too are victims of stratification based on their professions and are divided into three main classes and hundreds of subclasses. At the top are the Ashraf Muslims, namely Sayyid, Sheikh, and Khan, who trace their origin either to Western or Central Asia. Sayyid is highly revered and in status is almost symmetrical to Brahmins in Hinduism. Ajlaf, that means backward, and Arzal, as Dalit Muslims are collectively known as the Pasmanda, a Persian word meaning left behind. It is a term used for other backward classes. Leaders of backward Muslims claim that nearly 85% of the Muslim population in India is Pasmanda and only 15% belong to P orders. The community has often tried to raise the issue of its socio-economic backwardness and cited their numerical majority among the Muslim. Still, a tiny elite section, Ashrafs, remain in the lead position. They claim that out of the roughly 400 Muslims elected in the first 14 lower house of parliament, only 60 were from the Pasmanda background.
Muslims have gone to some lengths to perpetuate the myth of a casteless or classless community. But facts remain on the ground as the same notion has now come to haunt them as they struggle to push their claim for reservation enshrined in the Indian Constitution for the victims of the centuries-old Hindu caste system. The renewed debate on reservations spurred with the introduction of a 10% quota for economically weaker sections has led Muslims to revive their long-lasting demand for a share of the pie, arguing that theirs is amongst the economically most backward communities and therefore eligible to be included in the list.
After the recent victories in the state assembly elections, the BJP has intensified its groundwork to grab most votes in the civic elections. Political parties in Uttar Pradesh are all gearing up for urban local body polls in December. The ruling Bharatiya Janata Party in the state is planning a new experiment in these elections, which are being seen as the semi-finals for the 2024 parliamentary elections.